Now, did you use gloves to pick the cotton?
You could use gloves, but either way, if you use gloves, you would have to tear the tips off, because you can't pick the cotton with the gloves on; they're too bulky. And what would happen if you picked the cotton with or without? Well, even if you wear gloves, you want to tear the tips off, because, like I say, you can't pick the cotton. When you pick the cotton, it would tear your cuticles around your nails. It's got like real sharp prongs on it because it's opened, and it's kind of closed at the end, and it's like a big thick sticker that's there. So when you grab it, it just tears into your fingers. So after the season, your fingers are all messed up. Your fingertips right above your nails because they're all scratched, and then the top of your hands are scratched because it's going into the plant itself, and it's in some cases it was dry. If it wasn't that dry, then it was better because the bowl itself wasn't dry and it wouldn't damage your fingers. But you didn't want that because a lot of times you'd have to pull the cotton out. It wasn't quite ready, and you'd have to pull it out. The drier it was, the more the bowl would—it's called a cotton bowl. It was open. The more it was dry, the more it was open, so it was easier to pull it out, but it would mess up your fingers. Anyway, we did that. And that's the way it went during the day and the weekends. That's what we did on weekends. That's what my parents did every single day. During vacation, if there was any vacation in between that season, that's what we did. During the wintertime, sometimes it was tough for us. We didn't have any money, so I'd have to miss school. We'd have to miss school either Fridays or Mondays.
And we'd go. You have to do what?
Miss school.
You had to work?
Yeah, we had to work.
You had to miss?
We couldn't go to school. So we had to go to work. Yeah, so we didn't have enough money, so we had to go work in the fields. And so that's what happened. But this particular rancher had thousands and thousands of acres of cotton. Corcoran by itself, when it was empty after the season, the population was about 2,000 to 3,000 people. When the season, the cotton season was there, it was about, maybe 8,000 or 9,000 people had come in, and you could see trucks all over the place. The camps were full. The town was full. Things were pretty well alive. Things were the Christmas time was very special for our culture. We used to make tamales. My mother used to make them, not very often, but now and then. What they used to do at the camps is they used to, they would come in for Christmas. Boswell would come in, not him himself, but the foremans would come in with pickups. And their gratitude for the work we had done consisted of a bag of candy for everybody. It was a fairly large bag of candy, not too big, but maybe the size of a popcorn, a big, large popcorn. It was made of cellophane paper. And in it, you found those little round Christmas candies and an apple and maybe an orange and some nuts. And that was your Christmas from the boss, you know. Everybody got that. As the early 50s, the cotton picking machines started coming in. They weren't really quite developed, but every now and then you would see them out in the fields. And as years went by, you saw more of them and more. And so the camps started closing down. They took the tents down. So we ended up in three regular cabins. We were there for several years. And finally, it was hard to find work because the machines had taken over all the labor and picking the cotton. So the only thing we did was shop cotton. When that happened, when the machines started coming in, my dad and my parents found out that we could drive over to Fresno, to the Fresno area, 50 miles away, maybe, I don't know. But it was Fresno, and it was Fowler and Selma and those little towns around there. And we could pick grapes for raisin. And it was better than the fields, but it was still it was bad in certain areas, in certain ways, because when you pick grapes for raisin, the dirt is very soft, and we used to pick them in trays. We used to pick them in not in trays, but we used to pick them in pans, and then the trays we had were made out of paper, so we'd lay out the paper and then spread the grapes on them, and we did that. We spaced them out with a few inches in between, because they, later somebody would have to come by and turn them, because they turn into raisins. They do one side at a time. And that was, that particular work was, in a way, better, but then it wasn't, because when they grow grapes for raisins, they don't hardly do anything to the grapes. So a lot of times, they once in a while, they put sulfur on them to kill some of the bugs, but you can't get rid of the wasp. And some fields were just full of wasps. And you never knew, going from one vine to another, if you were going to hit a wasp nest. And if you hit one, when you open the vine to get to the grapes, I mean, they come right at you. And I remember I used to get bitten, the stung quite a few times. And at one time, I was out for about 3 days. So I had to go home, and I was home for 3 days. And I called it a blessing, because I didn't have to go work in the field. And anyway, but then I paid a price for it. I had my lip was completely swollen. I couldn't even, one side of my face was all swollen. And anyway, that's what we did for many years. And I was pretty good at it. I used to pick maybe 150 trays, and they were six cents a tray. So I used to make about $9 a day. Mm-hmm. And that was good money in those days, but I was real fast. I was real fast in picking grapes. Mm-hmm. Probably in my early years, I would say about 8, 9 years old by that time, 10 years old maybe. So that's what we did when we couldn't pick cotton anymore, because the machines were there. So we did that, and then we did that until the end of September maybe, when the raisin season just finally ended. And then we went back to the camps, and we did nothing. In many years, we did nothing until early spring. And we, just did nothing. We just sit there.
Because there was no work.
There was no work.
Yeah.
And there's one thing, other thing, that what was life in the camps during some of that time. There was 1 year, I think I might have been around the fourth or fifth grade by that time. We used to, when we weren't working, we used to hang around the camp and, you know, and do nothing, actually, just spend the day there and play around with some of the kids or get into trouble. Or when they had torn down taken down the tents, they built some big holes there that they used for trash and leftover stuff. So, like, you know, like kids that get into trouble, we used to go into those holes, and they were covered with the planks of wood. But you could lift up some doors, and we'd get on there and play around. Who knows what was down there? It could have been rats and spiders and everything else. But we were, you know, young kids. We were down there, and sometimes we would find some good stuff. Somebody threw away some good toys or something, so we'd pull it out and keep it and do whatever we want to with it. But now that I look at it, that's pretty dangerous, because those holes were deep. You could have just, something could have happened out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There was nothing else to do, and 1 year, we were barefoot, dark from all the sun, t-shirts, pants that were cut, so we had short pants, and then you know, regular shorts underneath. 1 year, and we used to be like little natives up there, all dark and tan and everything else. 1 year, we saw this station wagon drive up. There were two of them. I know there were more than one vehicle, but there was maybe a car or another station wagon behind it. And all the kids went over there to the end of the camp. It was at the one at the end of the camp. By this time, the camp had gotten down to two rows of cabins. It was towards the later years. two rows of cabins, so there wasn't hardly anybody to camp, but there were still maybe 20 families there. And it was the summertime, so you wouldn't find families there anyway. So we went over to this car because it was strange. And they didn't belong there. It was white folks in it. And everybody that lived in the camp were Mexicans. And we looked at this guy, and this tall man who walks out of the car. And we come up to him. We stand about 10 or 15 feet away. And then he opens up the back of the station wagon and takes out some toy that he had, something we'd never seen before. And I'm sure that if you went into town, you could buy it. But it was something a toy that he had, where you wound it up and it would work. It was either a plane or a car or a truck or something. And we were looking at it like a couple of natives that never seen something run before. And I think about it and I laugh about it a lot. It was funny. That's how basically uncivilized we were. We weren't part of the community in town, and these things we never saw. And so the guy says, come here. You want to look at these? And so we got real close, and he let us use it. And he says, well, we have a lot of more of these, and if you want to, we can come out here every day and help you out and bring some more of these. And so we said, yeah, that'd be fine. And we all agreed, the kids, and then the parents, some of the parents came up, and he introduced himself. He was Wally Stern from the California Migrant Ministry. They had sent out some people out there, and that's the first contact we had with him. Well, as things developed, he and his staff got us back into socializing with some of the with the regular folks. He would take us to the YMCA, the Young Men's Christian Association in Hanford, which is the county seat of that particular county. And he would take us to dinners, and he would take us to the swimming pool there. He says, we'd say, well, we don't have a swimsuit or anything to wear. He said, don't worry about it. Just come and you can go naked. I'm going naked. So we would go with him, and we'd go into this big, large swimming pool, and there was the only man out there. Everybody was naked. He was out there naked and jumping into the water. And we were embarrassed because that's not something here we are. That's not part of our culture. We don't walk around naked in front of other people. But it was funny. I mean, it wasn't funny then. It's funny now when I think about it. And yeah, pretty soon we're doing the same thing too. And I remember one of the first times we were coming out, he took us to Fresno one time, and we were coming out of Fresno. He says, I know this place, they've sold 1 million hamburgers. He says, what's a hamburger? Well, we knew very little about hamburgers, but we had tasted them before because during the time we would go to the county fair in Hanford, and there was a place where we could buy hamburgers for $1, which was good hamburgers. But anyway, he says, there's a place we sold $1 million hamburgers. They're real good. They're real inexpensive. Would you guys like some? He had about four, maybe five, six of us in the station wagon. So lo and behold, we drive up to guess where? Golden Arches. It was McDonald's. And that was in the early 50s. They were over at McDonald's, and so we got our first introduction to the Golden Arches and the hamburgers. You know, they had sold over 1 million hamburgers. So, during Christmas, they would go into town. They would get free Christmas trees, and they'd bring us free small Christmas trees. Obviously, we didn't get them until December 24th, you know. So, towards the last year there, we put them up in the window there. We had one window to the cabin. We put it in our cabin and put some boxes underneath, and you could see from the outside. And we hook up the wire up to the... and put a knob up there to take as a receptacle and hook it up to the electricity, and we have lights. I don't remember where we got the lights. Maybe they were right at them when they found them or something. Well, this went on with the migrant ministry for several years, and then pretty soon they would take us to different camps, different labor camps, and we'd play games with other folks here and games, and then they would take us on outings. They would take us to the river and picnics and everything else. They'd get maybe four or five camps together. We'd meet kids from the other camps. all part of socialization, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I remember meeting people I didn't know, girls I hadn't met, and boy, they were nice-looking girls. Sure got attracted to them real quick. Sure got some nice kisses, and I was about 8, 9 years old by those times. But it was fun.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually we had to kind of cut that out and go back to Flint Scott Sheriff's. I had to go back to work. And so they would come out, you know, only when there wasn't any work, and eventually the thing started dying off, and they started closing the other camps, and ours was the last to close. We moved from the 3 cabins to the one at the head of the at the camp. There were 2 big houses, and usually the foremans lived there, but we were the only ones left that had been there for many years, so they gave us a cabin, the house, and the house had you'd walk into the, it had 2 doors, one to the front, one to the back, and it had a garage. Cover. It was a cover. It wasn't a garage. And there was a door that came into the kitchen room there, and then a door came in from the back. You walk into the kitchen room back. To the left was a big room. That's where the boys slept. And then you keep on going. There was a small room, and that's where that was considered a living room, maybe 6 by 10 or something like that. And then to the right was another room. You drop down a step, and that's where my dad and mother, and my mother slept. My 2 sisters were in Delano. That's my older sister used to live there and work, and she was married to a Filipino. And my other sister went and stayed with her and eventually stayed there permanently. But anyway, we lived in this house, and it had a sink, and it had running water inside, but that's about it. The bathrooms were still outside. That one had a bathroom in the back, and the shower was outside. You'd have to go past another building back there, and a shed or something, and there was a shower there with a real dim light. And another thing I hated, because you sit down, there was grass coming in between there, and there was those black widows in there.
Mm-hmm.
I hated taking a shower there because in the dark, you couldn't find the black widows. And the walls were, you know, there were cracks in the walls. They were made out of wood. You couldn't really take a comfortable shower there because you never knew what could, if you came out, whether your clothes was a bug or a black widow in there or some kind of spider or snake or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it had wooden panels on the floor. Under the wood was dirt. And then you walk out the door and then past the threshold there. The threshold was basically nothing, and then you walk into the dirt and go back to the house. So we lived there until probably 1957. We moved back into town. We're not back into town, but they were going to close. They were going to close the camp. People started moving out. I think we were one of the last families that left. We
and
moved
so
into
what,
town. By, go ahead.
What? Well, so what grade are you in at this point?
Yeah, I was just going to get there.
I had
gotten from the 6th grade, and I started the 7th grade. And when we moved into town, Corcoran had a junior high school, 7th and 8th grade. That's where I was attending school. And I was already a 7th grader when we moved into town. It was early spring, I remember. So it was 1957. And I think it was around May when we moved out there. And we moved into town by the airport, by the airport market, by the store that from where I measured that first camp was, towards that section, but it was out in that direction. There was a small airport there. I don't know what kind of planes were in there. But I remember the street was, it was the number 3728 Bethel Avenue, Bethel. Avenue. There were no sidewalks. I think there was just a strip of some kind of asphalt there. And the house, you had a fence out front, a small picket fence, and a little walkway to the front door. You walk into the door, it had a small living room, about the size of half of a cabin, and it had a little gas outlet there where you put the heater. To the right was a bedroom, and then you go into the kitchen, and I think there was another bedroom there. And there was two bedrooms, yeah, and then the kitchen, and then towards, you go past another door, and there was a shower there in the corner. It didn't have a shower head, so the water just came out like in a direct hit. So my parents put a towel or something so the water would get into the towel, and you just pours down on you. And then there was another little room to the back. I don't remember what was back there, but might have been in the third small, real tiny room. And then towards, and there was a door to the back. And it's in the back. You go to the back. About 30 feet, there was an outhouse. So we didn't get everything inside. We got at least a running water and a shower. But the toilets were still outside, the wooden toilets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, we still continue working the fields. There were buses. By that time, the contractor, labor contractors had come in. They were doing a lot of the labor contracting with whatever was left of the work there to do by laborers. And we'd pick up, we'd get a truck, not a truck, but a bus. We'd catch a bus. It would stop every so many blocks around that area. And there were different heights. They called them heights in Corcoran. One was Perry Heights and other heights. And Perry Heights was very famous because there used to be a lot of mean guys there and a lot of fights in that area. We used to live, I don't remember what area we were out, but there was another height. But anyway, we catch the bus about 3 o'clock in the morning on weekends and on holidays and in the summer. And we travel. We'd go around picking people up and travel about 50 miles west to a place called Huron, H-U-R-O-N, and Avenal, A-V-E-N-A-L. And there were little communities way out there in the middle of the sticks, out west. And what was out there were melons, cotton, tomato, other things like that. And we would use hoes, you know, long-handled or short-handled hoes. You had, again, the mile roads. They were paying $1 a road in that time. That was 1957. We were making 60 cents an hour. A year later, we were making 65, and finally went up to 75 or something like that, 75 cents an hour. So we'd catch the bus at 3 o'clock in the morning, work 10 hours, come back, and by the time we got home, it was about 5, 6 o'clock in the afternoon.
So and once again, this was the whole family going on the bus.
Yeah, well, most of us, my mother was staying home at that time. She wasn't doing this thing anymore. My dad was staying, had gone to Selma, and he was gone a lot because he was working in the grapes over there doing something. I don't know what he was doing over there, but he would come back once a week and bring the money in. So that would help us out, you know. So he was gone quite a bit. And when my mother was staying, my sister, the second one, second to the oldest, in the meantime had gotten pregnant or got married when we lived in the camp. It was in 55. She got married and eloped with her, with a man, and went up to live in Washington because there were migrants there who came from Texas, and they went to the camps, and then they went up to Oregon to pick the apples and whatever was, I mean, Washington, whatever, hops and apples.
Mm-hmm.
And then she came back years later, and she, you know, she left him, and she had a child. So somehow we ended up with her daughter, which was what my mother used to take care of. And then for years there, when they would go to work, my dad would come back, and they would go to work, and they were only allowed older people or young adults that could work in the fields by the hour. By the piece rate, I could work anywhere. When it came to the hour, they were a little bit more strict because they were longer days. So unless we went like places like Huron, like in those buses, and it was a lot harder because there were labor contractors that had that, so anybody could work. But when you were in Corcoran, and like Boswell or some of the bigger owners there had put work out for labor contractors, they were real strict. They wanted to make sure no young kid was working by the hour out there. So my parents would go to work, and my brother would go to work, and I stayed home and I took care of my niece. As a matter of fact, I raised her, and years later, I'd have to skip school to go to her parent-teacher conferences.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we lived in this place until we moved back to Delano. And that was after I had graduated from junior high school. That was in 1958. My brother graduated from high school, my older brother, that year. No, my second to the oldest. And the oldest was, he had dropped out of school for a while. And so he stayed in Corcoran for I don't know.
So you went to Delano High School.
So when we left Corcoran, just as a little background in terms of my grades, my grades were always good. I was pretty high average, maybe. Not bright, but my grades were A's and B's and a lot of B's. We went early summer. We moved right after I graduated. We moved to Delano. And we got a house that was had a room in the front. We put a bed in there. Had a room in the middle, put another bed in there, and had a room in the back and put another bed in there. There were a couple of beds in the front room. The middle room had a bed, and that's where the kitchen was, too. I'm not sure, but I think it might have had a bathroom inside. It did have a bathroom inside, yeah. And so that was my first introduction. You know, I would work in the fields for many years, and this was the first introduction I got into table grapes.
Mm-hmm.
Paid better. Delano was a community mostly of a lot of Filipinos there, so the wages were a little higher than other areas. If you ended up working for somebody that had a Filipino crew, you think you made good money because they usually paid them better. They were more skilled, theoretically, or that's what they said. They were easier to manage also. And so we had, that was my first introduction to picking table grapes and cannery grapes. The grapes that went to the cannery. And so that's what we did that first summer we were there. And I entered the high school, Delano High School, and that fall. Again, my first meeting with the counselor, by that time my grades had been transferred over from the district in Corcoran. And my first meeting with the counselor, we were talking. And he says, what is it that I would want to be? And I said, well, first of all, I didn't tell him this, but in my thoughts I was thinking, I hadn't really thought about it, but somehow I told him I wanted to work in town someplace, maybe learn something to bookkeeping, or maybe see something about an attorney or something like that. That's what I told him. And then he says, well, your parents are farm workers, you're a farm worker. He says, I don't think you're going to have the money to go to college, so we're going to put you in a high school program. And if things get better for you by the time you finish in 4 years, then you can go to a city college or a community college. Bakersfield has a good college, and you can learn a trade there, is what he told me. So if you came from a family that was not a farm worker family, then you got put into college prep classes and learned algebra and biology and all those classes.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't put me in that. I did, by luck, end up in a college prep English course, which was, I was getting A's. It was an essay. We did mostly essays and stuff like that, but that was another bad experience that I had. I didn't get an A in my semester grade because there were about three sophomores in that class. And so the rest of the students brought it up to the teacher. How come we didn't get an A? He said, well, because I have three sophomores here, and it would look bad on them because they didn't get A's. And here you have a freshman get an A. So that kind of set me back mentally for a while. And,
mm-hmm.
Eventually, about my sophomore or junior year, I was real good in typing and stuff like that. But to go back a couple of years when I was a freshman, some of these setbacks kind of had an impact in me psychologically, and I kind of drifted off to the side and almost got in trouble with the wrong crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And another counselor came by and pulled me out of that, got me into the basketball team, which I hardly ever played because the coach didn't like the fact that I was put there without his permission or without his okay. And I did track 1 year and basketball. And I did intramural swimming and, you know, those kind of things. And they started what was called the Athenian Society in the high school. And because of my grades, I think out of the 8 semester, I think I made honor roll about 6 semesters. But and the Athenian Society was based on grades, and they had several levels. I think I made the 2nd from the top level because of my grades. And that was I was probably more proud of that than being the doing the honor roll for so many commencers, because that was the only Mexican there. There was another person with a Hispanic name, but I think he was Portuguese. But I was the only Hispanic, only Mexican, and a farm worker. And so a lot of the folks, a lot of the friends that I had developed there, a lot of Mexican Americans that didn't work in the fields, that had parents that had used stores, or they worked in the stores, or their parents worked at the banks. I mean, I became an idol to them, you know. Rudy, you know, you're the smartest kid around, and a farm worker kid. So that's, you know, there was this teacher that took an interest in me, and he says, you know, I don't know who did this to you, but there's no reason why you can't go to college. He says, you just take the what they call bonehead English and bonehead math, and it might take you longer, but there's no reason why you can't go to college. And so I continued in school. My grades were good. I graduated in 1962. He helped me get a couple of small scholarships. Helped me get in. He was with the California Teachers Association. He took me to a couple of meetings in Fresno. Fresno State College was called in those years. I liked the school. He took me just so I could get used to being there and seeing what the campus was like and what college life was like and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I applied and I got a couple of small scholarships, saved some money. During the summer, I was loading grapes. I wasn't picking grapes anymore. I was loading them into semis. I did that for a couple of years. I was 16, 17 years old. I think that's probably where I got my back damaged, and continued to farm work. And at one point, the last year right before that last year that I graduated was the last year I worked in that particular type of field work. It was real heavy. It was work that people pick for a cannery, and they pick in boxes. They're not your regular table grape lugs. They're bigger, heavier boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And they just throw the grapes in there because they're going to a cannery, and that's where you get your fruit cocktails and stuff like that. And they used to put them in boxes. We would go and cruise what we call swampers. And there was two guys on a trailer and a tractor driver. And usually three groups per crew. And we go down the rows, and there was a guy at the bottom that would pick up the box and put them on the trailer. The guy on the trailer would stack them up. And he'd stack them 8, 9, 10 high. And after a while, those boxes get pretty heavy, and you develop a method of just kind of flipping them with your wrist so you don't get tired. But your back is always taking it. Mm-hmm. If you're at the bottom, that's what you do. If you're at the top, you can stack them pretty good. And then after a while, you develop on how to kind of just, as it's coming up from the bottom, you just carry it without letting it land on the trailer, because then you got to pick it up. So with the flow, you got to kind of just push it up and just keeps on going up, and you stack it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the trailer's full, the small trailer. You drive it out, put it next to the semis, the flatbeds. You know, they had two trailer semis, and then you stack them on the semis. That's what they used to call double loading. We used to get 3.5 cents a box to do that. And the crew would do about 1,000 boxes. No, we did 5 loads a day, 5-6 loads a day sometimes. And they averaged anywhere from 9 to 1,000 boxes a truck. So by the end of the day, I mean, we were wiped out. I mean, completely, mm-hmm, exhausted. there were people that if we missed somebody would volunteer, and they couldn't do it. It's too heavy. The work was really heavy, and the reason I was able to do it when I was that age is because I drove tractor for other guys the first couple of years, and then I would kind of relieve them, and I got used to it. So by about the second or third year I did that, I was able to start doing more of it. So by the third year, I was doing it as one of the crew, and then the fourth year, I had a crew myself. So that was the last heavy work I did in the field. And then I attended Fresno State College. Huh. I moved in with some friends of ours, two other guys. We rented an apartment. And lo and behold, I started taking the class. I did good in some of them. And when it came to the science classes and math classes, I couldn't do it. It was just too far above me. I didn't understand it. So at the quarter break, I quit. I was wasting my time, so I went back to Delano. Hit the fields again. Did some pruning during the wintertime. And I'm not sure if I did the early spring there. I went back to school, Bakersfield Junior College, and I got into the regular business courses, business law, accounting, the non-transferable courses. Because mm-hmm. I figured, well, I don't think I'll ever go to college. I'm going to see what I can do and become an accountant. And I took some courses. And then I applied for a job in town. It was a shop clerk. It was a farm equipment place. And I got married by that time. So we had a little apartment in Delano there. Bedroom, living room, and a kitchen. I think we were paying $35 a month is what we paid. $40 at the most. So we were. I got at the job with somebody who knew me, recommended me, and so I did work orders, billings for the shop clerk as a shop clerk. And I was there from for about a year, I think, about 64 to 65. Don't go into the 80s. And I was getting $1.75 an hour, $1.60. And my supervisor was real nice with me. He gave me the ins and outs. He says, be careful with the big boss. Don't do this in front of him. If he comes in here, make sure you're not reading magazines or anything. He doesn't like that. Because we did have quite a bit of free time, and sometimes he'd show me magazines and stuff like that. He'd say, read this, or you might find this interesting, or something like that. But he told me, if Mel Hendricks was the owner's name, he said, if he ever comes around here, don't let him see you doing it, he'll fire you. So I stayed there for a while, and I took, I wanted to do something, so I took the civil service test for the post office. I had taken it sometime when I got out of high school, and I didn't do too well. So this time I bought a book. People told me to get a book, and so you learn how things are done in the post office. So I got the book, and I studied it, applied for the test, and ended up someplace in the high 80s or someplace up there. Well, very few people took tests for the civil service in Delano for the post office. They were lucrative jobs, and a lot of people, there weren't that many openings that came up. So during the time that I was working as a shop clerk there, an opening came up, and it was offered to me. I think it was $2.25 an hour, plus benefits. And I told my supervisor, you know, I hated to leave people. I felt like I was betraying people. And he says, take it. You're never going to get $2.25 an hour here. Take it. So I took it. and that was my first entry into civil service, although it was federal service, civil service. And it was the most boring job I've ever had. I mean, it was like an assembly line. You did everything at a certain time of the day. Came in the morning, 5:30 in the morning. We sorted first-class mail to a certain hour, a certain time. Second-class mail, a certain time, I think about 7:15, 7:30, we had to start putting mail up in the box. By 7:45, everything had to be put up. Then you go home, come back, and do another. My particular shift was split. I come back in the afternoon, and I helped the dispatch the mail that went out. So that's what I did. I did that a year and a half. But I was so bored. I was dying in there. People liked it. They said, no, no, it's a good benefit. You stay here 20 years, you retire, you know, or 30 years, whatever the case may be. I didn't like it. I didn't like it. And so when the farm worker union went on strike, I would spend that split shift in the daytime on the picket line. I'd go to the picket line. And it was during this time that that I had run into Caesar. I met him. We used to wear our clothing in those days were weird. We had colored pants, you know. I used to wear light green pants and a white shirt. Well, that's how I go to the picket line. I was a white shirt. At one point, Cesar Chavez asked Richard Chavez, his brother, "Who's that guy in the white shirt? He's always showing up in our picket lines, and I've seen him in the rallies. He's always come and talk to me." And he says, "Well, that's Tilly's husband. Tilly was married. Tilly's sister Sally was married to Richard Chavez, Caesar's brother. Caesar Chavez's brother." So that's Tilly's husband. That's Rudy. Oh, look, that was funny. So he started getting real friendly with me. But that's what I did in my spare time. I'd go out the picket line, and pretty soon they had me. Somebody in the union assigned me to take care of the two-way radios or something. I think Lenny Goldberg from San Francisco had donated a whole bunch of radios to us, and so we had those in the cars and everything else. And eventually, during that time, Tilly had gotten pregnant, and our first child was born in May. By that time, I had met Leroy Chatfield, Cesar Chavez. I'd been very involved with this union, with the farmers union. And somehow, either through you or through Cesar, the request came to me that you guys wanted me to leave, which was, I was anxiously waiting to be asked. So I left the post office. I left the post office, and I remember at the post office, I said, "Today's my last day." I gave him a date, and I said, "That's going to be my last day." And the supervisor wanted to keep me there longer, and so I I called Cesar and Chavez and told them they don't want to let me go. And Cesar says, "Well, you want us to call Washington because they had the UFW and Cesar had established some relationship with, I think it was either the Johnson or Kennedy administration in those years. Yeah, the Kennedy administration." So he knew Larry O'Brien, who used to be the postmaster. So he said, "You want me to call Washington? I'll talk to Larry O'Brien." I said, "No, let me see if I can take care of this first. If not, then I'll call you back." So I called the postmaster, who and Delano, who was a real good supporter of the union. He was pro-labor. He said, "Well, you know, we're just trying to work things out." He says, "You know, if you can help us cover this for a day or two, then you can take off. And, you know, I'm fully support what you're doing, but so-and-so didn't show up to work." And so I gave him one more day of labor, and then I left. Uh-huh. And that was the beginning of my tenure with the United Farm Workers Union.
And then you were there at the United Farm Workers until when?
I was there from 67. I was working for the service center. I was collecting for the credit union. I ended up in the boycott. About a month later in Philadelphia, was there for about 10 weeks, came back, went back to the credit union, was there till July of 58, and which is when we started the national boycott of grape, and we were shipped over to Montreal, and I was in Montreal with the family. They came back to Delano in November. I came back in Christmas, and Caesar didn't like anybody coming back in Christmas. But folks paid for me to come back, and I, you know, I violated one of the rules. And so Caesar greeted me warmly. And so I was in Delano for about a week and a half, and he involved me in some things. And then the day was coming where I was getting close for me to go back to Montreal. The whole thing in Montreal stopped. I mean, everything closes down the month of December and January. You can't do anything. It's cold up there. A lot of snow, 40 below zero. Nothing happens. Everybody just, they closed businesses the last couple of weeks in December. People just party up there. There's nothing to do except party. So I decided to come back home. So a couple of days before it was time for me to leave, Caesar comes over to the credit union and he says, I want to talk to you. And I think he took me into your office and he read me the riot act. And then he says, you know, there's a reason I tell you not to come back. And I say, yeah, I know, Caesar, I know what the reasons were, but there's nothing to do up there. So I figured I could do something better up here, at least for 2 weeks. He says, well, that being said, I'm going to give you a project. And here's what the problem is. Well, I already knew what the problem was. He says, we're getting, you know, Caesar, he's talking, we're just pissed, and we're trying to make a point. And sometimes when he wasn't, he was just trying to get the point across, using all kinds of bleeped words. He says, so I'm going to give you a big responsibility because I trust you and I want you to do this work. And I know you can do it. You're going to have the help of Father Dave Duran. You know Dave Duran? I said, yeah, I know Dave Duran. Yeah, well, he's a CPA. He's not only a priest, he's a CPA. So he's going to help you. And we're going to get this mess cleaned up somehow. So what I want you to do, I want you to go back. I want you to get your things. And I want you back here as soon as you can get back here. And then when you get back, we'll finish talking what you're going to have for your responsibilities and everything else. And your title is going to be Comptroller, he says, at the United Farm Workers. First one. never had a controller. And here I had about maybe one full year of accounting in college. Whatever bookkeeping I had was we were there in the credit union. And I got dumped at, I think I was about 22, 23 years old, with the responsibility of a national union, keeping the finances, make sure everybody stayed straight. That was a lot of trust.
Yes, it was. And because I was there with you at that time, I have to tell you, you did an amazing job, and everyone trusted you. And the most important person that trusted you, of course, was Cesar Chavez, and
right.
that made all the difference. So,
yeah.
Rudy, I think we should conclude this interview now. It's been wonderful, but it's gone on a little longer than normal.
An hour and a half already.
Yes, but to me, and I'm sure to others who will listen years from now. It is very interesting and even amazing that so many farm workers who became exposed to the farm worker movement through Cesar Chavez and his farm worker movement, that became the springboard for so many to launch their careers and to launch whole new engagements that they didn't even know that they could do or that they were qualified to do. So with that, I want to thank you very much, and I will talk to you later. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye.